Welcome, everyone. I'd like to open the Senate Committee on Health Policy, February 14th, 2005. Happy Valentine's Day and happy birthday, Oregon. And it was Gresham's birthday, 100-year birthday on Friday.
And today's my wife's birthday.
And it's Senator Cruz's wife's birthday. So lots of celebrations going on. We are going to open into a subcommittee since we don't have a quorum on Senate Bill 490. So will Tom Hole and Linda Howry please come forward?
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt. I'm executive director of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 490. I've submitted written testimony, which I'll summarize. Senate Bill 490 is really quite simple. It removes an existing restriction on pharmacist immunization practice, which currently is only allowed for patients age 18 and older. Bill 490, as presented, would remove that restriction entirely and allow pharmacists to provide immunizations basically to anyone who needs one. Currently, the way our immunization practice works is that pharmacists by rule are required to operate under protocols that are approved by Oregon Health Services, and each administration of a vaccine is required to be reported to the patient's primary care provider. So they do get informed of the administration of a vaccine. That's something other providers are not required to do. As of the end of 2004, we believe there were 409 immunizing pharmacists at about 150 locations around the state. It's a pretty good percentage compared to other states. We began this practice after we were first authorized to do it in 1999 under a bill that Senator Cruz passed through his committee in that session. Since that time, we've done about 100,000 immunizations, as near as we can determine. Not a single serious adverse event out of all those that we're aware of at this point. So we think we've done a pretty good job in terms of providing a quality service. And about a quarter of those are administered in rural areas where access is a real issue. So the question becomes, why do we want to mess with a good thing? Why make the change? In short, because pharmacy patients and other providers and a number of other folks have begun to ask us to. Linda Howry is here from Fred Meyer. She's director of clinical care, and she'll speak to this a little bit. But we've had increasing reports over the last couple of years of parents being a bit frustrated, as well as other providers being somewhat frustrated that pharmacy can provide an immunization to a patient who's 18 years old in a day, but not to, say, a 17-year-old. And in many cases, these are patients who have other identified high at-risk conditions, such as diabetes or asthma, and they should get, for instance, a flu shot, and the pharmacist can provide it to mom or dad, but can't provide it to junior, and people just don't understand that. During the vaccine emergency this last fall, I'll give you a couple of examples. Some of the hoops that we've jumped through to provide service in spite of the restriction. In Hermiston, we had pediatricians wanted to send their patients to the local Safeway pharmacy, which had vaccine. Others in the community did not at the time. There were about 125 identified at-risk patients under the age of 18. Safeway very graciously provided the vaccine, did all the paperwork, sent it over to a hospital where it was administered by a nurse under prescription orders from the pediatricians in the community. So there was a lot of work went into providing the immunization service that, if we passed this bill, wouldn't need to be done. We could just get right to providing the service. We had a clinic, but in some urban areas we also had similar reports. There's a clinic in Portland that wanted to send its patients to a pharmacy, and again, the pharmacy could not provide the service. We think that younger patients deserve to have the same easy access to immunization services that other patients have. We certainly have no interest in getting into, you know, well baby checkups and that sort of thing, but we do see a need for a service here that would provide easier access to needed immunizations. Just last week, there was another vaccine approved for meningitis that's going to be recommended for all college students. Under the law today, we would not be able to administer a meningitis vaccine to a patient age 17 headed off for college or headed to do their campus visits as part of their application process. And I think those are some examples of the kinds of services we could provide. Pharmacists generally are relied upon in this service not as a replacement for other medical services, but more as a convenience to patients and to be an access point. We have heard some criticism of this proposal based on the idea of a medical home, the concept that the patient should have a physician who basically manages their care, as I understand it, and has all of their records. Well, we do handle, we think, the record part of it by reporting to primary care. But again, we don't really see where that has come to pass. We saw that argument raised in 1999 when we first sought immunization authority, and I've attached, for just for your reference, an example of that argument that was raised 6 years ago, and you can consider that. We've had conversations with the Centers for Disease Control over the last year or two about, you know, ways that pharmacy could be used to expand access to immunization. They're very interested in that. And we think that loosening up on the age requirements would be one way to go about that. We were informed very late in the day on Friday that Oregon Health Services would perhaps offer testimony in opposition to the bill. Based on the idea of the medical home, but also based on a supposed fiscal impact for reporting vaccine administration to the state's vaccine registry. And without knowing the details of that, I would like to speak to that issue. One, we think that
I'd like to close the subcommittee and open a full committee. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
On Senate Bill 490.
It made you think a while there.
Wanted to hurry this up. Sorry.
I didn't think anybody said it was that bad. we've had, I think, over the last several years, what I think Oregon Health Services would agree is a pretty good working relationship with them. And we do believe that any fiscal impact is quite minimal. As long as the department is willing to sit down with our IT folks and let us know how the data needs to be reported to them, it's really just a matter of another data report out of existing pharmacy systems. Most of the immunizations, our data show between 85 and 90% of the immunizations are done by Fred Meyer and Safeway, and the rest are done by a relatively small number of other stores. We have coordinated very closely on training and data issues with all the providers, and would continue to do so in terms of the vaccine registry. So we don't really see that there would be a hard cost to the state there beyond sitting down with our folks and working through whatever the data requirements are, and then we could provide the data. There's been some concern expressed also about potential increased demand on the Vaccine for Children program, which is a federally funded program. In surveying other states that have lower age limits or no age limits on the pharmacist immunization practice, as near as we can tell, there really just is not much interest in participating in this program because of the administrative difficulties of it. But nevertheless, as a show of good faith, we have asked LC to draft, unfortunately it couldn't be ready today due to their workload, an amendment to the bill that would draw the line at age 12, and for patients under age 12 still allow a physician or other provider to send their patients to the pharmacy, and the pharmacy could still provide the vaccine under a specific order. That's just a good faith effort on our part. We're comfortable with the bill either way, so we leave that up to your discretion as to what you would like to do. Just to sum up, we believe that, you know, we've certainly proven that pharmacists can be a good resource for immunizations, that we can perform the practice very safely and at a high level of quality. And I think we've been pretty good partners with public health in increasing access to immunizations. In the last two seasons for flu, we weren't able to do it this year because of the vaccine emergency. We worked with public health to do an outreach to indigent patients and provided free vaccine to 2,000 or 3,000 patients each year in cooperation with health services. So you know, we've certainly been willing to go the extra mile to work with folks in this area. And with that, I'll be happy to take any questions. I think Linda has a few words she'd like to say speaking to the demand issue on pharmacies.
Senator Cruz.
Palma, at what age is parental consent for an immunization no longer required?
Chair Moss Anderson and Senator Cruz, I don't know the answer to that question. I could certainly get it for you. We haven't had to deal with that yet because we're only doing adults.
Right. I was just wondering if 18 was the...
I believe it's 15.
15?
Lorraine, yes, she's 15. Yes, 15.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Linda Howery. I'm a pharmacist. I work for Fred Meyer. I've been real active with the immunization program since it started. And one of the things that's become increasingly difficult in practice is in a situation where the family comes in to do shopping in one of our stores, and mom and dad come in to get their flu shot, and they bring their asthmatic 17-year-old or 15-year-old, there's nothing we can do. We can't help them. This year it was increasingly more of a problem because there was such a shortage of vaccine, and with all the long lines, there were numerous children that we had to turn away knowing that they could not go to their pediatrician to get the vaccine. I think the other thing that I would like to point out is this year was the second year that FluMist was available. Again, that would have been an excellent alternative for kids, but because of the age restrictions, we weren't even able to administer FluMist to the pediatric or the kids under 18. So that would have saved a lot of the vaccine available for the high-risk adults that we could have substituted FluMist for the pediatric patients.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. I'd like to call then Jim Lace. And Lorraine, you want to come up too? Jim, do you want to go first?
Thank you. Chair Williams and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify. I'm Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician from Salem, Oregon. I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. I'm here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 490. First of all, I'd like to thank the pharmacists for being able to help out with the flu vaccine. That's been a tremendous benefit for everybody. We really appreciate that. I want to remind the committee that is one vaccine against one disease at basically one time of the year. It's not the complicated pediatric schedule that we have for 9 different diseases and up to 20 different injection schedules when you get into that. If the flu vaccine is used as the primary example for why we need to expand the vaccine administration to include the pharmacists, I would suggest that we actually fix the supply of the flu vaccine and go to the federal level and ask them to come up with a better schedule so that we're not 2 months behind in getting our vaccine. Why the pharmacist should be able to get their vaccine ahead of the doctor's office, I'm not too sure. But there are very clear rules about who could get the vaccine and who couldn't get it. But just taking the pharmacist and throwing them in and saying, gosh, have them start vaccinating children doesn't really improve the whole issue about the vaccine supply. This year, as you know, I've heard previous testimony about, you know, half the flu vaccine had to be thrown away because the preservative that was in there was improper. So I'm not sure that's a good argument to expand the vaccine administration to include the pharmacist. What I'd like to do is just run through a couple of things. Did this testimony last week a little bit, just to remind everybody, we have 9 different diseases, 20 different vaccine schedules potentially. Children come into our office, go out of our office, they come in with different levels of vaccination. Not all the vaccines are comparable, they're not all in the same efficacy. We have to pick and sort a little bit out and try to match that out. We don't just do vaccines in our office. You know, the whole concept of the medical home, I think, is a very serious concept. We look on that as a way to provide medical services for children. We just don't vaccinate children when they come in. We do vaccinate kids. We just have shot days in our office where we do that. But those are to our existing patients. We already know their medical background. The whole concept of the medical home is a very, a worthwhile concept. And the idea of throwing that out or just kind of downplaying that and saying, oh, gosh, you know, it's not really an important thing, I think is not in the best interest of the children in Oregon. We have 2 different vaccine suppliers in the state, Vaccines for Children program that comes through the state. Those vaccines come to us. We are allowed to administer those. We have an administration cost, but after that, the vaccine to the patient is free. Then we have our commercial vaccine supplies, and those are charged through the insurance company. We have to keep those 2 lots of different separate record keeping is different. If in fact we have an issue where we think that the public health system or the vaccination program for the state is broken, I would suggest that we spend more money on the infrastructure through the health division and say, okay, gosh, how can we make this better, rather than widening the pool for having more people to administer the vaccine. The record keeping is a rather onerous thing. We have to keep our records up to for 10 years after the aging majority, which is 18, so we have to keep our records for 28 years. What happens, we heard today that most of the people doing the vaccines are going to be the big pharmacies, but what happens if a smaller pharmacy is a business and then goes bankrupt or discloses like Dave's Pharmacy opened by sale? What happens with all those records, are those gone, whatever? And so we have a little concern about the issue of record keeping and the liability that's involved with that. We have 98% of our children vaccinated by school entry. That means 2% are not. Those 2% are either because of the parents having religious reasons and or medical reasons for the child not to be vaccinated fully. So that we, in fact, actually have a pretty good system. And why we want to suddenly change that or increase the available pool of people to vaccinate, I'm not too sure. Right now, to have the vaccine form that the children need for preschool or for school entry requires a signature of a health provider. Right now, as far as I understand, the pharmacists are not included on the list. That would have to be changed to include pharmacists as a group to be able to sign off on this. And I think that has to be I'm not mistaken. We have complicated kids that come into our office, HIV children, children with cancer, kids with other immunocompromised situations, kidney transplants, liver transplant, heart transplant, you name it. Those are complicated children, and knowing what vaccine to use, what not to, to give, is best done within the context of a medical home where the child can come and actually have the advice. If I'm not sure, I call a specialist to take care of the child. Is it okay to do this vaccine? We have live virus vaccines, we have dead virus. Dead vaccine. The other issue about liability, which I'm not sure if this is a viable one or not, when we give a vaccine in our office, we're liable for it. If a child gets a vaccine under our order at the pharmacy, who's liable for it if there's an untoward outcome to that thing? Are we still liable? Are we either going to be the deep pocket, or does the pharmacist become liable if there's going to be a reaction to the vaccine? Likewise, in that situation, if there is a reaction,
can you move the microphone?
Sure. It says do not move. I'm following directions
here. He's just following orders.
So, and then the other issue comes up. The flu vaccines are, like I said, one vaccine, and that's going to be the majority of the vaccines that they've been administering. When you get into our other vaccines, we do have reactions to that. We know that. Parents call us up, we go through that, and we actually have them come back into our office. If they get a shot reaction at 2 a.m. or at the weekend or whatever, the pharmacist to my understanding, are not able to diagnose, nor are they able to treat other conditions. And so now they'd be placing themselves in a position of, oops, now what do they do? Who does the parent call? So I think it's better to keep the vaccine program within the context of, you know, where the children come for their primary care. And again, going back to the flu vaccine, we had patients who were clearly needing the vaccine. We didn't have the vaccine in our office for 2 months. Why did other, you know, like the Costco, the Safeways, the Fred Meyers, why did they have the vaccine and we couldn't get the vaccine where those high priority children come, you know, to see? We need to fix that program rather than just, you know, change the whole system in terms of providers. There's two different advisory groups right now. We have the Red Book Committee on Infectious Diseases from the American Academy of Pediatrics. We also have the Public Health Service Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Those two groups are usually in sync. This whole thing coming out with the new meningitis vaccine for college-age kids and above, that's going to be a big issue. It happens to be the wrong vaccine for the type of meningococcemia that we have here. We have type B. This one's against four types that we don't even have in the area. So that's a big issue, and we actually have to sit down and tell people, well, it really won't protect your child if you're going to go down and be a duck or a beaver. If you're going to go back east, where actually you have these strains, then we tell them, yes, get that vaccine, or if the college requires them. But we don't have people saying, gosh, I couldn't get that vaccine. But like I said, for if it's going to come out and be advised, in this area, it really doesn't afford that kind of protection for our children. The other thing is, you know, this whole HIPAA rule, you know, about, you know, patient confidentiality. You know, we have to undress the pediatric patients. It's not just simply rolling up the sleeve and give them a shot and they're gone. Children are undressed. So, in fact, the way we interpret the rule in our office is that we have individual exam rooms with closed doors because the patient's going to be undressed for that vaccine. Pharmacists would have to offer that same level of confidentiality, closed rooms, single rooms, door shut. So that's just another issue that would have to be, you know, kept in mind. Then the other thing is we try to keep our kids vaccinated on schedule. That means that we dearly love our nurses, our nursing personnel who do these vaccines, and we want the parents to keep coming back to get the rest of those childhood vaccines. We would be concerned that if you got into the hustle and bustle of a pharmacy, that it would be very hard to get that individualized attention to a mom with a two-month-old baby or a six-month-old baby. They're screaming, they're hollering. She's got three other kids that are running around, and it's a chaotic situation for any of you who have children or pet children in the past, as you know. And for all the above reasons, we do not think that this would be in the best interest of the children of Oregon. So we would urge your vote no.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Would you have objections if they just limited the vaccine for the flu, for flu of children, just that one vaccine?
We would like to actually fix the flu distribution system. Mm-hmm. We want that vaccine in our office on October 15th, the same day the pharmacies get it. And then we wouldn't have this terrible, horrendous situation that we had this year. So we would still say no to that because we need to fix the flu distribution system first. And then if it was proven that in fact those patients did not have access to that, we'd have to reconvene and talk that over as a group. But right at this point, we would oppose that.
What is this a cost factor as well? Is it cheaper for them to go to the pharmacy and have the vaccine than it would be to make an appointment with the doctor's office and go in and do that? It seems
no,
to
because
me.
We just do shots only. They don't have to come in and see me, for example. We just have shots.
I see.
They just come in. Remember, we have two different systems. Mm-hmm. We've got the Vaccine for Children program that comes through the state. They give us the vaccine for free. We have an administration cost, which is $15. $15 or $16. In fact, we actually probably lose money on vaccines, to be real honest with you. But we don't look on that as a money-making or generating, you know, income for our offices. We do that within the context of providing the full pediatric package. So I would, you know, I would assume that the pharmacist would be in the same position. They would get the vaccines for free, and they could have their administration charge of $15 or $16. On the commercial side, they would have to go through, you know, whatever the commercial contracts would allow for that.
Thank you.
Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So let's say we get the distribution system fixed. You would still prefer that the parents go one place to get their flu shot and the kids another place rather than just to be all taken care of at one stop?
Yes.
And that's good access?
Well, because they can come in our office. We have days we just set up for nothing but flu days. That's how we do the flu vaccine when they
Well,
come
Madam
in.
Chair, and that's absolutely wonderful. You got families who are busy and the parents are working and they're going to take their kids and they're going to go and they can all get a flu shot, all get protected in one place. And you're saying that's a bad idea, that the kids need to go a different place.
We think that you should keep pediatric care within family practice or within the pediatrician's office and not, you know, throw that open to other providers in terms of the vaccine. Remember, we don't just do vaccines in the office. And so we would, I mean, we're not trying to be hoggy. We're not trying to be selfish and just say, gosh, this is a turf battle and we're worried that the pharmacists are going to take us over. But we want to keep that within a coordinated care. And the whole idea of a medical home is a very serious thing. We don't take that lightly. We think that, you know, children's office, you know, where they come for their care, parents want to go to one spot. They know they can come there. We have that vaccine. We've had it in the past. You know, the last two sessions, we've not had the vaccine in a timely fashion, and it's been awful. And then we have things from the state where we're going to get penalized if we give the vaccine to the wrong person, you know, potentially. And so it was an awful year this year. Now we have plenty of vaccine all of a sudden at the end when the flu's not making much of a shoulder season again, like last year.
Senator Cruz.
You know, when it comes to the immunization schedule, which is incredibly far more complicated than I could understand, I can see that. I guess if we're looking at getting the flu shots, you don't get the flu. You know, that's not part of your immunization schedule. That's a whole separate issue.
Yes, it is.
And you know.
And we run full days with nothing but flu shots when we have the flu vaccine.
Well, so do pharmacists. So, I mean, you can go in there and get a flu shot. I guess I'm just wondering how it makes sense to force a family to go to two different places to get something that they could potentially get in one place. How, you know, I mean, for a lot of families, getting the time to go take care of these things is a premium. And so if we can make it easier for a family to make sure that appropriate people are getting protected, how that's a bad thing. I don't understand that.
It's not a bad thing. We just want to do that within the context of what seems best for children. So, and at this point, I mean, if the committee decided that they were going to carve out the influenza vaccine as the only vaccine to do, you know, for the pharmacists for children less than 18, we'd have to think about that one. We're not asking, you know, this bill, the way it is written, says vaccines for anybody less than 18, all vaccines. You're not carving out just the influenza vaccine. So this bill, the way it's written, we're in opposition to. There's no question about it.
Any other questions for Dr. Lacey? Thank you so much. Is it Lace or Lacey?
Lace.
Lorraine?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lorraine Duncan. I'm the Immunization Program Manager for the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to request that you oppose this bill. With that said, I'd like to clarify something. We have worked really closely with the Pharmacy Association and the pharmacists in this state for a number of years. They have been the greatest partner. They have done an outstanding job, and I just want to recognize them for that, because at every turn when we do adult immunization, they're there to help us, and they partner in every way possible. So I'm feeling bad about this, and I'll explain why, but I just want you to know that there's not a better partner in regard to adult immunizations than the pharmacists, because they've done an absolutely great job. There's three reasons why we're opposing this, and the first one is that none of the national advisory boards make this recommendation. Also because there's no evidence to justify that pharmacists have improved immunization rates for children. But the main reason that we're opposing it is one that's been going, the reason is in regard to the medical home. And this issue is because we have a Immunization Policy Advisory Team at the Department of Human Services, and they provide recommendations to the department. There's 18 voting members, non-DHS staff, and they've looked at this issue. They've invited the Pharmacy Association to come and to talk to them, and they were not in favor of this, primarily because when children go to get their immunizations, they don't get just one shot on a day. They need to look at all the shots that are due that particular day, and sometimes they get a number of different shots. So if they were going in for a flu shot, but they could also have additional vaccines, we want them to do that. But the issue is in regard to the medical home. Like you indicated, it's very difficult for busy parents to go a couple different places. So if they go to the pharmacy, then they might not get back to the doctor for 6 months or 9 months or a little bit longer. And then they don't get the other preventive health services that they're looking for. So our advisory committee has said to us it's really important that the Department of Human Services honors the medical home and makes this work. And I'm sorry that this doesn't work for the Pharmacy Association because they've been the greatest partner. And I really feel badly about having to say that. Thank you.
I know that that the Pharmacy Association has been working with you regarding possible amendments to this, with an amendment of age 12. And how would you feel about it if the cutoff age was age 12?
The response would be the same as our advisory committee indicated to us that the medical home applies to the adolescent like the child.
Ma'am.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Well, I'll pose the same question that I posed and Senator Cruz followed up on. Would you object to immunization for vaccine for flu?
The only reason that I would object to that is primarily because when they get injections for flu, especially little ones, they get three or four different shots. So they don't just go to the doctor's office or the pharmacy to get one shot. They might get three or four. So if you just licensed it for them to get the flu shot, they couldn't get the other one.
Okay. May I follow up,
yes,
please? What age, you said little ones, up to what age do they get the multiple shots?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, they for flu vaccine, they start getting it at 6 months, and then most of the childhood immunizations are complete at 24 months, with the exception of hepatitis A, which starts at 24 months.
So the up to 24 months, then, it could be more complicated after.
If I can add, sure. Up to age 5, actually, when they start school entry, because there's another slug of vaccines that they need for school entry. And then after, realistically, what happens after age 5 and the child starts kindergarten and all their immunizations are completed, it would be 10 more years before they need a booster, so it would be age 16.
Okay. This is getting out of hand. May I add one more? We're talking about flu vaccine. Okay. Not all of the other combinations. So after 24 months, could conceivably a family take a child in and have a flu vaccine shot without interfering with the other schedules?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the problem is that many children fall behind in their schedule. So instead of getting the immunizations when they're supposed to, they might be way late. So a child might not have gone in to get their DTaP 3 or their polio 3. So, but it's a lesser degree at that point.
Well, would getting a flu shot and a pharmacy at age 3 interfere with any other vaccine schedule? It's a one-time, once a year, and it probably wouldn't even happen every year, but if they did go in for that one shot in a pharmacy, would that interfere?
Only in that if they needed to have other shots that day, they'd have to go somewhere else to get the other shots. But
Point's
well taken.
Thank you.
Is there any other discussion? I would like to have Tom Holt come up and address the age issue and the type of vaccination issue. And I know that it's extremely frustrating for... Go ahead and have a seat, Tom, and you can stay if you would like in case we need to address you. When a child needs to have a tetanus because they're going at the age 16 or 17 when they're going to go overseas, or if they want the flu, with an adolescent, it is an access issue. I truly believe it's an access issue. I have reservations regarding the complex immunization schedules that they're on, even up through middle high, because even when they get into middle high, we seem to always have kids that aren't properly immunized against measles, mumps, rubella, et cetera. So, Tom, will you please respond to what the others have said?
Chair Moss Anderson, members of the committee, as I noted in my earlier testimony, we certainly would be willing to compromise.
Identify yourself again.
I'm sorry. For the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. We certainly would be willing to compromise on an age level. We don't have an interest in doing, well child checkup type of vaccines for very, very young children. We do have an interest in being an access point when parents need a vaccine and it's convenient for them and there's a need. Our suggestion would be to, we come to some agreement around an age, but allow physicians and other practitioners to have the flexibility to order an immunization to be provided by a pharmacy when that works for the parties involved, so that there will be a specific order from a physician to be able to do that, and everyone knows what's going on. And we certainly don't have any interest in breaking up what we think is one of the things that I think has worked very, very well in the immunization practice that we have in Oregon and is unique in the country, is the fact that we report each immunization to primary care. No other state does that, and it's made us a national model for these types of practices.
Is that how you, each pharmacist isn't required to report their immunizations right now with children to the Oregon Immunization Registry?
Chairman Anderson, no, we're not, because we aren't immunizing children right now. So.
Okay. Any other discussion? I would like to have you work on an amendment, share that with the OMA and Department of Human Services, and I'd like to hear this again.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 490, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 189. And... Okay, there's no one really here to testify. This is a bill that we heard. There was no opposition to it. I would entertain a motion. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 189, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 189.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 189 to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Senator Cruz has moved that Senate Bill 189 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, would the clerk call the roll?
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator George?
Yes.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Chair Montana?
Aye. Motion carries. Senate Bill 490 will. I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong one. Okay. Senate Bill 189 has passed with and I would like to have. Does anyone want to carry this? Senator Morissette, do you want to carry on?
Okay. It was a suggestion of Senator Cruz that I carry this bill. I'd be very happy to.
Thank you.
Well, she looked this way. I just died.
Well, being the nurse.
Thank you.
You sure?
Yes.
Okay.
I'd be very happy to. I'd be proud to carry this.
Okay. I'd like to close the work session on Senate Bill 189. Okay. And we have some legislative drafts. LC 1650 and LC 2789. Is there a motion? 2781. Okay. I'd like to open a work session.
For the consideration
for the consideration
bills.
Of committee bills.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move LC 2781 and LC 1650 be included as committee bills.
Senator Cruz has moved that LC 1650 and 2781 be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. I'll close the work session on introduction to committee bills. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 458. And is there a list here?
Good bill.
Okay, let's call Doug Barber, Gary Allen, and Steve Duffin to the... And does Paul want to come to...
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Doug Barber. I'm here today on behalf of Willamette Dental Group. Historically, Oregon has had very restrictive licensing laws for dentists. That has made it difficult for out-of-state dentists to come to Oregon. Gradually, over the last four sessions, we've worked to remove some of those barriers. So this is an issue that may sound familiar to many of you. In 1999, we passed a bill that gave the Board of Dentistry explicit authority to recognize the clinical dental exams from other states and regions. In 2001, we passed a bill saying Oregon would recognize the license of experienced dentists, those with at least 3,500 hours of practice, from elsewhere in the country if they had a clean practice history and met other qualifications. That leaves the issue of more recent dental graduates, and that is what Senate Bill 458 is designed to address. With me today are Dr. Gary Allen and Dr. Steve Duffin to describe some of those difficulties we still face in bringing qualified dentists to Oregon.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Gary Allen, and I'm a dentist licensed to practice in Oregon, Washington, and Virginia. And I'm retired from the military after a 26-year career as an Army dentist. I am currently employed by Willamette Dental as Director of Clinical Support for Quality Improvement and Training. And Willamette Dental is a group practice with over 50 offices in three states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and we employ nearly 200 dentists. I'm testifying here today on behalf of Willamette Dental and myself in support of Senate Bill 458. During testimony today, you will likely hear that this bill is not necessary, and I will address some reasons to the contrary, but mostly my testimony will be based on common sense, fairness, and experience. The primary reason Senate Bill 458 is necessary is because there is a problem with access to dental care in Oregon and the nation that is due in large part to the growing shortage of dentists. Some will argue that the shortage is overstated. And perhaps that's true in selected urban areas and for people who enjoy adequate dental insurance benefits. But it is not the case in the rural areas of America and Oregon. Many areas in Oregon have been documented as underserved, and the problem is expected to get worse over time. The American Dental Association's workforce model projects a declining number of dentists relative to population growth through the year 2025. Willamette Dental recruits nationally for dentists. On numerous occasions, we have found qualified candidates educated elsewhere who desire to move to the Pacific Northwest, but they cannot get licensed in this state because Oregon does not recognize the Northeast Regional, the Southern Regional, and other states' examinations for initial licensure. In most cases, Willamette Dental did not lose the services of those dentists because we were successful in recruiting them to our offices in Washington. But Oregon was the loser in a highly competitive national and regional marketplace for dental services. The greatest concern you will hear against opening up initial licensure to candidates who pass any U.S. regional or state examination is that other tests are inferior to the Western Regional Examination for evaluating candidates. The Northeast Regional Board is the one most frequently characterized as not being up to the same standard, and successful candidates of this board are therefore branded as unqualified. Yet, 26 states do recognize the Northeast Regional Board for licensing dentists, as does the federal government. During my career in the Army, I served in a number of postgraduate education and supervisory jobs that allowed me to evaluate the performance of hundreds of dentists from virtually every dental school and licensing jurisdiction in the nation. And my position with Willamette Dental for the past 6 years has given me the same opportunity to review the performance of dentists initially licensed in several different states. Based on observations over 30 years, I have seen no relationship between a dentist's competence and the licensing examination he or she happened to have passed. You will hear that this bill is not necessary because there is a movement to create a national licensure examination. And that is true, that there is a movement towards a standardized test. But there still is no consensus as to what the examination should look like, nor how long we will have to wait before it is available. In addition, there is no assurance that Oregon will recognize the exam if it is ever developed. Evaluating the merits of this bill, I encourage you to consider findings of legislators in the state of Washington when they recently opened up licensure to all state and regional testing agencies. And I quote, "The legislature finds and declares that access to dental care is severely hampered by a critical and emergent shortage of dental providers in Washington state. Dental disease is an epidemic among poor children, the elderly, the disabled, and anyone who does not have access to adequate dental care. Shortages are due to licensing restrictions that have discouraged qualified dentists from coming into this state. Access to dental care and disease rates in Oregon are not substantially different than in Washington. The difference is that they seem to get it, and we don't. The fact is, we are competing for a shrinking dental manpower pool, and we need to act. If this bill fails, Willamette Dental will not lose, but the citizens of Oregon will. I strongly urge you to favorably consider Senate Bill 458.
I'd be entertained. Thank you, Dr. Allen. Dr.
Duffin. Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Duffin. I'm a member of the Oregon Dental Association, and I serve as the dental director for Capital Dental Care, which is a dental care organization that serves approximately 100,000 citizens under the Oregon Health Plan. There is a shortage of dentists in Oregon. This is especially true with respect to access to care for low-income children. More dentists retire every year than graduate in this country. I have been active for a number of years working with both the State Board of Dentistry and the legislature to craft licensure procedures that would permit Oregon to be more successful in attracting qualified dentists to our state. Progress has been made, but there remain steps to be taken. I have gained permission to share the story about two pediatric dentists, a husband and wife team, who chose to come to the Northwest to live and raise their family. In the summer of 2003, Dr. Jimmy Yoon contacted me about a position with our organization in Oregon. When he came for an interview, I was delighted to learn that his wife, Dr. Susan Kim, also was a pediatric dentist. Both dentists had graduated from Columbia University School of Dental and Oral Surgery. This is where they met and eventually married. Dr. Jimmy Yoon was a couple of years ahead of Dr. Susan Kim in dental school. After graduation, both dentists passed the National Dental Board examinations and the Northeast Regional Clinical Board and received licenses to practice in New York and New Jersey. They then completed residencies in pediatric dentistry in New York City. Soon thereafter, they decided that they would like to relocate to the Northwest. Because Washington State will recognize the Northeast Regional Clinical Examination for initial licensure, and Oregon does not, Dr. Susan Kim was able to obtain a license in Washington, and Dr. Jimmy Yoon obtained an Oregon license. Ironically, this couple found themselves living in Portland, one traveling north across the Columbia to work in Washington, and the other traveling south to work for Capital Dental Care in Oregon. This was an unfortunate and understandably stressful situation for these two pediatric dentists. Sadly, they made the decision to move to Washington in order to work and live together in that state. There is no logical reason for a discrepancy between initial licensure procedures to exist between Oregon and Washington. I would encourage the legislature to take action to remedy the situation. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Is there discussion? I find it really sad that we lost two pediatric dentists, which are very sorely needed in the state of Oregon, because Washington accepts a dentist with no experience, and California does too. Is that correct? Do you know if California has a residency?
No, California's rules are different.
They're different altogether.
let's not go there.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. And if you'll stick around, I'd like to call Paul Cosgrove.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association, and we're fully in support of Senate Bill 458. I'd just point out that Section 2 of the bill addresses the exact same issue with respect to out-of-state dental hygienists. And although last week there was testimony elsewhere in the building, on the other side of the building, about a shortage of dental hygienists, which may or may not be arguable, there's clearly a maldistribution of healthcare professions, including dental hygienists, to rural areas of Oregon. There's certainly no doubt whatsoever. And I'd just point out that dental hygienists are not intending to be protectionists. We're happy to have qualified graduates of accredited schools from other states come and practice here in this state. We don't consider that a problem. We consider that a benefit. Section 2 does exactly what Section 1 does for dentists. Section 2 does for dental hygienists. Secondly, dental hygienists have a real interest in Section 1 of the bill having to do with dentists. Most dental hygienists must practice under the general supervision of a dentist. The shortage of dentists, in other words, impedes the ability of dental hygienists to provide their services. And even with respect to the independent practice dental hygienists who have a limited access permit, they find people they can do the prevention and the education and the services that they're trained and licensed to do, but they need dentists to be able to refer those kids to in order to get the restorative work. This is really part of a package of bills that hopefully you'll be seeing. Many are starting on the other side of the building that can help improve oral health care and access to oral health care. This doesn't solve all the problems, but it is an important piece of that package. And this is one, ironically, that I think you can act on, and we hope you will act on, that doesn't cause expenditure of scarce general fund dollars. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Jay Willem from Oregon Dental Association.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jay Willem. I am... no problem. I am the chairman of the Government Relations Council for Oregon Dental Association. I'm a private practitioner here in Salem for the past 13 years, and previously practiced in the Air Force for 11 years. About 75% of the dentists in Oregon are members of the Oregon Dental Association, and the vast majority of our members oppose Senate Bill 458. When I was preparing for the testimony, I looked at the mission statement of the Board of Dentistry, and it is to assure the citizens of Oregon receive the highest possible quality of dental care. I think we would all agree with that. Many of our members wonder why a group or anyone would be interested in lowering the requirements to practice dentistry in the state of Oregon. Is it a good idea by law to establish Oregon as the lowest of the 50 states in terms of being an entry point for licensure for dentistry? We think that this bill would drive down the standard of care, and we are concerned about negative effects on the public as they relate to the quality of dental care. I think the equation is very often that those with the least training and those with the least clinical experience have the potential to do the most harm. They are frequently the cause of complaints to the Board of Dentistry. Another concern is the direct impact on the Board of Dentistry itself. The board is operated with fees paid by dental practitioners. Our members think that they have a right to be concerned about the impact of the legislation on the board's budget. Second only to the amount spent on salaries and benefits, the board spends the next largest portion of its budget on attorney fees and other costs related to the discipline process. We also have concerns about the effect of repeated legislation. The legislature had this same concept before only a couple of sessions ago, as mentioned by previous testimony. And through negotiation with all the concerned parties, the clinical exam obstacle was lowered at that time. That change allowed practitioners licensed in other states who have taken a different clinical examination than that required by Oregon, that being the Western Regional or the Central Regional exam. Those people could apply for licensure if they had practiced 3,500 hours in the past 5 years. This argument was the product of legislative direction to the Board of Dentistry and the interested parties and was negotiated. Another question that comes up by our members is whether it is a good idea for the legislature to make decisions about the adequacy of clinical exams. Is it not the responsibility of the board members who help conduct the exams and have the background to make these judgments? It is the present position of our members, and I believe the Board of Dentistry, that the Western Regional Examination and the Central Regional Examination provide an abundant pool of qualified and potential applicants for licensure in Oregon. For these reasons, our members oppose Senate Bill 458.
Senator Cruz?
How different are the regional exams?
Pardon me?
How different are the various regional exams?
Well, I can only tell you that from my experience being in the military, I can tell you that I feel the quality, and this is my opinion, the quality of clinical instruction in the Northeast is much different than that on the West Coast. And I saw that. I taught in the Air Force in residency program. And I can tell you that the young dentists that come from the Northeast section of the country, the clinical standards are not the same as the West Coast. And that is why, over time, the Board of Dentistry has chosen the Western Regional and the Central Regional as the two boards that best meet the needs of the citizens of the state. And I think if you specifically the exact requirements of the exams, I don't have the knowledge to give you that answer, but I think we could find that out through the board.
I lived in Virginia. Is that considered Northeast or not? Where would Virginia
well,
lie?
Well, that may be South Regional. I'm not sure where this. Yeah.
That may be Southeast. It's close to Washington, D.C. That's sort of middle. That was when I was in my 30s for about 10 years, and I had to go to the dentist. I hadn't had any cavities when I lived on the West Coast, but I certainly had a lot when I got to the East Coast, and I don't know what there was. But I went to a dentist, and I saw no difference in the quality of dental care that I received on the East Coast compared to the West Coast. And it's the same with my nursing degree. I got my nursing degree in the state of Virginia. I know it's probably different than the training that I got here, but I moved back here to be close to family, and would have been very trying on me as a single mother with two children to have to find a job or have to, I wouldn't have been able to come back to Oregon unless I was able to practice my nursing. So I view this as when we are in such a critical shortage of healthcare workers that we would deny someone who was trained on the East Coast to practice on the West Coast, which is the best place to live. I find that troubling. Can you address that other than you think that their qualifications would be less?
I would just say a respectful difference of opinion. And That's all I can say to that.
Okay.
May I?
Yes, yes. Senator Morissette.
Do we have a copy of your testimony?
No, but I could provide that.
Yeah, in case I want to argue against this bill, I'd like to have a copy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Weiland. Is it doctor?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Patrick Bratz from the Oregon Board of Dentistry.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patrick Bratz. I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Dentistry, and on behalf of the Board, I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide information today. The Board has not taken a position on this piece of legislation because it came in after their last Board meeting. I have shared the bill with all the members of the Board, and I have had a couple of them email me back or call me with some questions or concerns, but sitting as a whole, they've not had a chance to actually talk or discuss this this bill. What I'd like to do and provide, be able to answer questions if I can or get the information for the committee, is I'd like to go over some statistics, and I apologize, I should have. In anticipation of the hearing, I reviewed some statistics regarding what's happened since the legislation actually was created to have licensure without further exam. And so what I'd like to do is review that with the members of the committee, because I think it might answer some of the questions that you have, especially in the areas of access. The legislation, or the Board, implemented the legislation on January 1 of 1999. And since that time period, the Board has licensed approximately 979 dentists and 937 dental hygienists. 733 of those were what we call initial licensure, meaning that they had taken either the Western Regional Boards or the Central Regional Dental Testing Examination. And you should be aware that those two examinations encompass 34 states of the United States. The license without further exam individuals, there are approximately 150 individuals that we have licensed since the law went into effect. Eight of those individuals have already let their license expire. Nine of them have pending applications, and seven of them never bothered to complete the application process. During that same time period, we have 81 of the initial licensure people's license expired, seven actually resigned their licenses, and none of them are currently pending, and there's no 180 days incomplete. During that time period, we received 20 complaints regarding those licensed without further examination individuals, and we received 155 complaints regarding the initial licensure people. Disciplined, the Board actually disciplined eight of those initial licensure people, and five of the licensed without further exam. We actually denied two of the applications because the people weren't qualified. So if you look at the statistics, based on the fact that it is a smaller number, approximately 3.2% of those people that applied for license without further exam were disciplined by the Oregon Board of Dentistry since they received their license in this state, approximately less than 1% of initial licensure. But this is what I found very interesting. Of the individuals that we licensed in this time period, 73% of the licensed without further exam people have an in-state address, or so basically 53% of them are here in Oregon, where 77 of them live outside of the state of Oregon. Now, seven of them are in Vancouver, so we include those sort of as part of Oregon because we understand that they might live in Vancouver but yet practice in Oregon. So what's interesting is that one of the issues regarding access is the fact that these individuals who were able to get a license never bothered to come to the state of Oregon to practice. Now, I don't know for what particular reason, if they just, as Senator Anderson was saying, being in the West, they wanted to have a West license, or this license enabled them to get a license somewhere else, because there are some states that do have that, that if you have a license in certain jurisdictions, you can then get a license easier in that jurisdiction. And the similar statistics, as you see here for dental hygienists as well, we've licensed about 937 individuals during that time period. Again, I was somewhat surprised about the number of people, especially dental hygienists, who got a license but yet didn't bother to come to the state of Oregon.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Cruz.
So you're assuming on that last point that if they don't have an in-state address, they don't practice in Oregon? I mean, could it be because we know of some folks who might practice, let's say, in Seattle and then have a practice a couple days a week in Hermiston or something like that. So is that factored in here?
Chair Anderson and Senator Cruz, it's not necessarily factored in there. I did not run the entire statistic. We were trying to generate some of this on Friday, and actually there was a break in the fiber optics, the T1 line that goes between Salem and Portland, and so we weren't able to do some of the things that we want to do with our computer on Friday. So you are correct, Senator Cruz. There could be some individuals that are in Seattle and do come down and practice in the state of Oregon. But again, I don't think that's a real large number. I can get that statistic for you and can break it down who those people are.
Well, another thing, Madam Chair, might be those who live in Boise and practice in Ontario. So, I mean, because they get tax breaks for that. But, I guess the problem I have with just statistics can do lots of things, and I'd also be interested, Madam Chair, in of those who were disciplined, what they were disciplined for, whether it was administrative functions or practice violations or what it actually was.
And Chair Anderson, Senator Cruz, I agree with you, and unfortunately with this bill coming up as fast as it did, I did not have, this was just something I kind of sat back and looked and said, I think the committee might want to know this, because I know access is an issue. I think Mr. Cosgrove put it out really very well. It's not only just access, it's maldistribution. And no matter what you do with licensure requirements, you are not going to solve maldistribution. Just before I left the office, I also ran some statistics, which I don't have to hand out for you, but I can, as to where did the people that actually did come to Oregon, where did they practice? Initial licensure, Multnomah County, 143. This is out of a total of 517. Washington County, 108. Lane County, 29. Clackamas County, 63. Duchesne, 23. The license without further exam, the individuals that the board allowed to come in since 99, where did they go to practice? Multnomah County, 20. Washington County, 9. Marion County, 2. Lane County, 12. Deschutes, 5. Clackamas County, 3. So again, you see what's happening is they're going to the areas where we already have the majority of dentists. I think one thing that would be important, and unfortunately I was not able to put this together, is I think it would be good for the committee to hear from members of the board who actually do examinations and have been a part of the Western Regional Boards, the Central Regional Dental Testing Boards, and some of our members of the board have actually also participated in some of the other regional board exams. They could tell you better than I could as to what are those specific differences, because I know that was one of the questions that the committee asked. Again, I'm not saying that the board is opposed to this piece of legislation. They haven't had a chance to talk about it. Some members have called me that they do have some concerns about it. One of the concerns that I have, I've been in regulation now for about 13 years. I'm not an Oregonian. You probably can tell that from my voice. I'm always told I have an accent. I'm from Wisconsin, and in Wisconsin I did about 13 health boards, including dentistry. Is the one concern I have is when you lower or you get rid of that 3,500 hours of practice, you could have someone from another state who has a dental license, who has not done what I call active practice, meaning physically in someone's mouth, for many years, simply getting a license and coming into this state and now being able to practice. And I'm not so sure that that's the kind of people that you want. I know that's definitely not the people that Willamette or Capital Dental, because I've had some conversations with them. They're focusing more on the new graduates and things of that nature. So I just think the committee needs some information, and we'll be more than happy to provide it, and I wanted to be here today to try to answer questions that you might have, because I know you are concerned about access, and so is the board, which is one of the reasons why recently we just created a new volunteer dentist and dental hygiene program, which I was anticipating being able to meet with some people today to work on a press release, but unfortunately I had to be here instead, so we'll get another day when we can do that.
All right. Discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very much. Is that it? Yeah. Is there... Doug, can you come back up here? Just ask a question of you. Have you met with ODA or the Oregon Board of Dentistry, and is there some neutral ground you can meet on here? Or
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, again, my name is Doug Barber here representing Willamette Dental Group. We have not met with the ODA on this bill. I talked with Patrick Bratz from the Board of Dentistry last week, and
if you desire, we would be happy to sit down with him to address some of those issues, particularly the last one that he mentioned around if there are people who received a license in some other state but have not been actively practicing, and you wanted to make sure that the board could set up rules to require that there's active practice, that they have the skills. Those aren't the people that we're trying to deal with in this bill, so we'd be happy to work with him on language that would address that concern.
That to me is the only issue that I would maybe have, because I hadn't heard of that. I mean, maybe that is
I hadn't until the other day myself.
Yeah. Senator Cruz, did you?
No, I'm okay. Agreeing with you, Madam Chair. Okay. That is probably something that needs to be addressed in simple amendment, I would think.
Well, I do plan to bring this back, and so if there's no further discussion, or yes, Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the testimony from Gary Allen, he pointed out that Washington appears in 03 changed their license to open up to all state and regional testing agencies. Has anybody here in this room heard any horror stories of anything that's gone wrong relative to anyone who's now been allowed to practice in Washington?
Chair Anderson and members of the committee, no, we have not. Now, we don't have actual data to support that, but we have brought ourselves a number of dentists into the state of Washington, and again, you know, the level of confidence seems equivalent to those that have been licensed through other Western regional exams or Central regional exams. The legislature, when they passed this, or the state of Washington already had rather liberal licensing laws, but they still had some requirements similar to Oregon's. They looked at that data when they considered opening it up even further as to what their experience has been for dentists that had been licensed without further examination, and they felt no need. And as you heard from the testimony that the legislators themselves included in the record, that there were no issues of public safety that would detract from the greater issue of access to dental care.
Okay. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, just one more comment. When we did our tour of rural Oregon a couple interims ago, one of the things that one of the glaring issues that was facing us was the fact that, number one, there were very few dentists operating in eastern Oregon, and number two, they're all near retirement age. And you know, so an access to health care that has been acute is on the verge of becoming critical, and so we need to do whatever we can to make sure that we have access, and to have access you have to have practitioners.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morrison.
And I seem to remember it was the dentist in John Day that was saying that he wanted to retire and he couldn't find a replacement, so he was staying there.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, could I make one final statement regarding Mr. Bratt's testimony? And, you know, I think a lot of that, the data that he shared, the devil is in the details. But particularly in addressing some of the issues of out-of-state dentists who may be licensed in Oregon, I know that the dentist that was talked about earlier, Dr. Yum, resides in Seattle, but he practices with Capital down here in Oregon 4 days a week, is the note that I got. And I know from our own experience, we have dentists who reside in our office, or practice in our offices primarily in the state of Washington. However, they do hold Oregon licenses, and we bring them down when we are facing a shortage in one of our offices here in Oregon, and they practice for whatever period of time until we can recruit somebody else to that practice. So, you know, I don't think that in itself means that the licensure without further examination rule that was passed favorably at a previous legislative session has not been successful. I think it actually has been successful and very helpful. And I believe that opening it up even further would be helpful in the same regard.
Thank you. No further. Senator.
Just one quick statement. This is totally off of the mark here, but I'm going to say it anyway. Over the years, I've farmed some very marginal ground because that's what I do. The only reason anyone farms marginal ground is because there's too much competition in the rest of agriculture, for the good ground. So you're forced to take the poor ground. What I'm suggesting here is that there's a relationship with the amount of number of people who might be available as to whether they might farm the bad ground of Eastern Oregon relative to a very high-pay, successful practice. So I think it is important that we consider that, is that, many times people make that decision on the fact that there is maybe not, in other words, if there's competition out there, I will go ahead and take a look at a less favorable, what didn't meet my original expectations, but yet I did it and was able to make a living supply necessary commodity based upon that.
Thank you, Senator Urey. Okay.
Whatever that was, you
said. I don't know.
Just a small problem.
Peter understood the farm of the ground.
When referring to Eastern Oregon as background, I don't think I'd go there. But,
I have soil mess.
Okay, well, if you'll work on some language there, and I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 458. And do we have anything else? Meeting's adjourned.